All right. I think that we are starting with KW for our first thing. Why don't you read yours and then discuss it with other people who discuss it.
The first one, it's probably a little convoluted how I wrote it, but I'll read it and then maybe explain it a little bit. Instead of technological protection, what if intellectual property is treated as a service instead of a product? And just because we've done a lot of talking about like trying to protect people's copyright, creative copyright rights in a way, but you know, what if we look at it a different way and sort of is treated as sort of like kind of everybody has access to it? Because it seems like, in my head, the more we're trying to protect something, people are still going to get it, you know, still trying to break into it, still trying to steal it, and then at some point it makes it like more difficult for the person that actually wants to use it, like the good Samaritan, if you will, trying to use it, it makes it more difficult for that. So what I was thinking as an example, there's an open music model that came out in 2007, so a fairly new model, and instead of like paying for like every music download, you sort of pay like $5 a month, and you can download as much as you want, and let's say I, you know, purchase a copy of product or song A, and then Lisa takes it off of my share, and then, you know, people take off my share, and the artist's name is recognized, and we're like, well, that artist, it's been downloaded. Like,
but are the people who are taking your copy,
they're also subscription.
What if they aren't subscribing?
What if they aren't subscribing?
Yeah, they're friends of yours, so what prevents... Because the answer is many of these maybe if the price is low enough people don't bother.
Right.
But in terms of sort of the logic of the system, what prevents your friends from simply getting copies of the songs from you rather than paying for the service?
Right. Well, it doesn't, but it's just sort of like the price is so minimal and it's so easy to get. I don't think you can ever stop piracy, but if you just sort of make it like a non-issue, like it's more of a hassle if you like try to like share it that way.
The next step is I'm a enterprising pirate, and what I do is that I subscribe and I download a huge number of songs, and I then set up my own website somewhere outside of the U.S. where the copyright owners can't easily get at it, and I sell. I charge $2, so I charge nothing but put ads on my site.
Right.
How does the provider of the service prevent that? Yeah.
Well, that's why I asked the question. Like, would piracy still be an issue? Yeah. Like, as big of an issue as it is today?
Because one of the advantages that you can do with your service, which trumps the case of my getting it from someone else, but doesn't trump the organized pirate,
right,
is recommend things. You can say to people, look, rather than you are asking for songs, you ask for songs for a while, and then we'll tell you which song we think, judging by your past taste, you'll like. And you can't duplicate that for your friend. So in that sense, you're getting an extra benefit.
Right.
But in principle, somebody could duplicate that if they had stolen all of the songs in there.
Yeah,
because many of these things, it may be that the best answer in practice is just make things very cheap and people don't bother to pirate them. But sort of the other part that intrigues me is that your service is beginning to look a little bit more like Westlaw or Lexis or World of Warcraft, something
right,
where the stuff involved isn't getting to you, it's up on the server and therefore can be protected. But that works against your friend copying from you because your friend would like to have a choice of a million songs instead of just the 23 you've downloaded.
Right.
But it's not clear that it works against either a system where a bunch of people online all share their stuff, which has been done before,
right,
or an organized pirate. All right, let's go on, and let's see. Our next person is there we are, right next to you.
LJ. Yeah, so my question, I guess, sort of feeds from what she's talking about, which is, like, you know, sort of boiling it down to one service, but my idea is that what if, you know, the major movie producers all get together and they say, well, you know, instead of having, you know, distinct little groups like Amazon Instant and Hulu and all these different service providers, Netflix, we just sort of all collaborate and only work with one company, and then that's the website where the service is authorized, and we make it a subscription fee that you have to pay to access any content that you want to access. So it would be like Hulu, except there's only one place you can get it, and then if you put the digital watermarking idea into practice, then
you're watermarking separately each download.
Right. So then, you know, and it wouldn't work for images pictures, and it wouldn't work for something where you could, like you said, like print it out and then scan it back in.
Yeah.
But for something like a whole movie, if they put in the digital watermark, could they then say, you know, presumptively, anywhere outside of my authorized website, I will assume it's pirated?
Why do you have to have a single firm doing it? Why couldn't you do the same thing and say the copyright holder on the movie says Amazon can sell this as they want, but if they sell it, they've got to watermark it, and here's our software for them to watermark it with. Wouldn't that work or not?
Well, what I was thinking is, you know, there's already a lot of movies out now that are, there's a physical copy of them. So
right.
I could take my legally purchased copy of Fight Club and put it into my computer and then transfer the information onto my computer, and there it is in the hard drive.
Yeah.
That is my legally purchased copy. If I don't share it with anybody, I don't think I'm breaking the law there.
Right.
But it's really hard to separate, you know, if you just flag it, it just happens to be, you know, something you can find on the internet. Say if I put it on my private site, you can't access it. I can make an argument that that's not, I'm not opening myself up to piracy claims there. But because it would be so contrived, especially for a movie that hasn't come out yet, so there are no physical copies of it yet, if they refuse to release hard copy DVDs, you know, that's kind of what I'm getting at.
I'm not sure. What are the elements of your ideas? The central idea that you don't release DVDs and only stream it, or is the central idea that you do it through one outlet?
It's that there is no, like, way to get at it except this one outlet. And there's no real space copy, so there's nowhere for pirates to go to claim that they have a legitimate source, because the only legitimate source is this one spot. So in that way,
why does the pirate have to claim a legitimate source? Why doesn't the pirate download it from that thing with or without the watermark? He's not going to care. He has a website someplace which is hard for the copyright owners to get at, because it's a big world and there are a lot of jurisdictions. And so he makes it available, again, for advertising or for a price to download lower than your price to download. How do you prevent that with your system?
Well, that's the thing, is I think nowadays with the SOPA thing, we're starting to crack down on all the sites that do any of that. So
SOPA was defeated.
Well, yeah, but in the wake of SOPA, a lot of websites went down. MegaVideo went down, MegaUpload went down. BitTorrent, BitJunkie, sorry, I'm kind of revealing myself as a pirate right now, but there's a lot of websites that just shut down, and YouTube is being policed like crazy now, so yeah, they are ending a lot of the venues for piracy. So
there will be
more cropping up.
But suppose we didn't do your system. If suppose we've got DVDs the way we do, insofar as what you're saying is true, insofar as you can prevent online sharers of illegitimate stuff, since if I claim I have the DVD, that doesn't give me a right to share it. So why is it any easier to enforce the copyright law with your system than with the present system? Why don't we just say, all right, if the copyright owner finds anybody online who is sharing his stuff, he goes after him legally the same way he would in the case we're discussing. I'm not sure I see how your changes solve the problem. That's what I'm trying to.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm just not really sure how they're doing it now, because it seems like they're just scaremongering with the legislation.
And that may just mean that it's going to go down for a couple of weeks, and then some people will find some place where the local law enforcement people are bribable and go back up again. I don't know.
But I've been noticing that a lot more now, the actual legitimate, like, copyright holders are just jumping on the internet bandwagon, whereas before they were sort of avoiding it. And I could just see that would be something they might try to do, is to monopolize it and then just start saying, you know, presumptively, anywhere we spot this watermark, because it's efficient.
But anywhere we spot it being available for download, they've got them anyway because of copyright law. Right? So now you could say, suppose you imagine, what I don't think is very likely, a world where there are web spiders that are able to search all machines connected to the internet. All right, that sort of is an upper bound of what you can imagine as eliminating privacy. And these web spiders are entitled to report if they find a recording of any of these movies on a hard drive anywhere. And since in your model, I have no legitimate way of having a copy on my hard drive. Whereas in the existing model, I bought the DVD, I put it onto my hard drive so I wouldn't have to run it in the DVD, perfectly legal. So if you imagine that there are good search mechanisms, as it were, then your model has the advantage that there's nobody who's got an innocent reason to have a copy on his machine. But it still doesn't protect you against the pirate whose machine is outside the U.S. and not being searched, and who streams it to people inside the U.S. so they never have it on their machine either. But, all right, let's go on. Let me see. I'm the next one. But I think I was actually going to go on and reverse the order because I think mine goes with Susanna, I think. I don't see it.
I'm right here.
There you are.
You move.
Power. I was wondering where you've gone to. All right. So why don't you read yours and then I'll do mine. I think they're actually related.
Okay. Should copyright owner be forced to give up some of their exclusive rights, i.e. the duration of the right, if they are permitted to constrain a consumer's use of their work, limiting the number of archival copies that it's made, or limiting the types of software, hardware, deployed to work. So in addition to this, I wrote, there's a really nice introduction in this law review article that I read part of. I'm sorry if people on that side of the class can't see it, but it kind of conveys what's going on in a nice kind of almost a little fictional story about what it's like to release a movie and prevent the movie from being copied. Things that the copyright owner does, such as limiting the types of software and hardware that the movie can be played on by entering into these licensing agreements with, you know, say a software or hardware company. And so I think that one of the biggest debates that I came on in doing my legal research is that the right of the copy owner, in addition to extending the rights of the work, is now extending almost to a monopoly on the technology that they're claiming that they play the work on. So if they're permitted to put these constraints on the work, should they have to give up some of these exclusive rights? And I put duration because I'm just thinking kind of like intro to intellectual property now. I think the life of a copyrighted work is the life of the owner plus 50 years in the U.S., which I think is an extremely long period of time. So perhaps if copyright owners are constraining the way that we can use illegally purchased work, should they have to cut that period down to, say, 10 years or 20 years?
I guess the question which was raised to me, and the reason how it was connected to my question earlier, is what's the downside of copyright? That is, if you say copyright is an unambiguously good thing, then why would you want them to shorten the term? And if it's not an unambiguously good thing, then you'd like to think about what are the bad things about it that might make you want to restrict it in various ways, which is why it links to my question of whether if you had good technological protection, it would then make sense to abolish copyright. So do people have suggestions? Are there important ways in which the world is better without copyright? So that in your example, is it better that after 20 years it vanished instead of after 100 years or whatever it is in practice? Any thoughts? Everybody thinks copyright is not unambiguously bad. That's a good thing. And here I'm probably the only person in the room who actually gets income from copyright. Yeah?
I think the extension of it places too much emphasis on the fact that they should be benefited for future generations.
Why? Why is it too much? What's the damage?
The damage is the ability to build off of existing works and create new things and side ventures or additional, like Shakespeare adapted a lot of histories and other works in order to make his works, and no one can do that too.
Except that I do not believe that any of Shakespeare's things would have been a violation of copyright law if there had been copyright law. Because what he's doing is taking plots, not quoting the text. And copyright protects expression and not idea.
Well, he definitely quoted some text at some times, but...
Where does he quote text?
I don't know. I don't remember now. It's off my head. But
I mean, his plots are sometimes lifted from earlier works.
I guess he lists from himself while he lists from himself.
That you're allowed to do.
I don't know, I guess I also think a lot of the reasons why copyright was originally founded in the United States kind of got lost along the way, and it's now, instead of incentivizing people to create, it's now rewarding people for creating.
What's the difference?
If you have a class of people who are able to create works and live on their works, they're wanting to create more works, whereas if you someone creates a work and you let them and their children live off of it for generations, they have no incentive to do anything.
I think you overestimate how large the royalties are for most copyrighted works. I think that, with rare exceptions, if you want to live off the revenue from your work 40 years from now, you are going to starve to death.
Then why have it? Then why protect it 40 years from now?
The argument is...
It doesn't benefit the author in any way.
But the argument is not that it doesn't benefit at all, but you're supposing that the benefit is there's no incentive to do other productive activities. And I think that would be a very... Not that there are zero cases, but there are very few cases where that's the case. No, it seems to me there are two different issues here. One of them is, what is the benefit of having copyright, the other the cost. And in terms of the benefit, my guess is that cutting it 20 years doesn't really matter very much. That for almost all works, after 20 years you're not getting any revenue from them. I don't know what the figures are. My first book was published about 40 years ago. And it certainly has got a very poor rating on Amazon at this point, but I probably still get a few dollars a year from it, but pretty negligible. So I think that if you can make a good case that copyright has serious costs, then you can plausibly argue for shortening the term. And excuse me, you started that because the argument, I think it's a stronger argument for patent, but an argument for copyright as well, is that intellectual property is an input to making other intellectual property. So if you think, let me give you a real case, which is one I actually encountered. And that's, as I think I've probably said before, one of my hobbies is cooking from very old cookbooks. There is a 13th century Andalusian cookbook, which was translated into Spanish sometime in the last 50 years. And I, at one point, wanted to get it translated from Spanish into English. And I was unable to successfully make contact with the original translator. Without doing that, my translation is in violation of copyright law, because a translation of a translation is a derivative work. So you could argue, look, it would have done him no harm at all. After all, he didn't end up getting any benefit from mine because I didn't do it. And it would have been a benefit to people who want to know about 13th century Spanish cooking. So you might argue that, and it's a stronger argument the farther you go ahead, because, of course, if something was published last year, it's probably pretty easy to find the copyright holder. Whereas if it was published 40 years ago, you know, the author may well be dead. How do you find out who did it? And so forth and so on. So it seems to be the argument you want to make, and it may be a good argument, I'm not sure, is that copyright, especially long terms of copyright, imposes serious costs on people who want to use the stuff as input. Now, that wouldn't be true in a world of zero transaction costs, because then if I want to use it and it's worth more to me than cost to him, I'll just make a deal with him and, you know, pay him to it. But if you're talking, about a copyrighted work that is not a world-famous work, 30 or 40 years later, it may be fairly hard to find out who owns the copyright and do anything about it. So that would be one argument. So now, going back, you want to have it the price of restrictions. Why is there a connection between the two? Why is there a connection between the fact that I am distributing my song in a way that can only be played 20 times, or I am distributing my movie in a form that can only be played on certain hardware, which hardware won't copy the movie? Why is that connected to restricting the term of copyright?
Well, the argument there is that it's restricting, at least what I got out of this article, it's restricting user innovation, that any sort of changes want to be made to the hardware or software that's used to convey the expression of the work, that they have to eventually go get permission from the copyright owner or whoever the partner is in a licensing agreement. So it stifles that component of technological innovation as well. I think you made the point that after a certain period of time, at least the monetary rewards that somebody is getting from their copyright is diminishing to a point of possibly zero. So, should we take some of those rights and start cutting them down, saying, okay, if you're going to enter into this licensing agreement, then, perhaps these other exclusive rights you have, we should give some of those up. Because it throws the whole concept of why we have copyright protection off.
But it seems, I'm not sure it does throw the whole concept off. That is the fact that I am only letting my GUI be played on a machine which is designed to keep you from copying it, that doesn't undercut. I mean, that's just a way of enforcing what copyright rule is supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but then arguably extends your right to that machine, right? Because it's under anti-circumvention law, if you tinker with that machine in a way to release your work, then you're liable.
If someone else tinkers it in a way to release my work, yeah.
Yeah, so that's.
A different way of putting your argument, I'm not sure if it's right, but let me try this, is that as the enforcement of copyright becomes more costly, as the nuisance to other people if you're enforcing copyright becomes higher and higher, you are less and less willing to extend copyright. So if we imagine, so you might say, suppose we had a world where the hassle associated with copyright enforcement was zero, where somehow, when I put on the copyright, anybody who tries to copy will burst into flame instantly, so nobody ever does. And anybody who wants permission to use it can easily reach me and they go through. In that world, we wouldn't mind permanent, infinite term copyright. But the more we're moving to a world where it's really hard to prevent copying, and because it's hard, the things we do that are expensive are costly in the sort of way you describe, that becomes an argument for having shorter terms of copyright. See, let me take the argument further, because I would say that speaking as a consumer of intellectual property, I'm in the odd position that I'm one of the plaintiffs in a suit against the Google settlement, partly because Richard Epstein was a plaintiff and I have a high opinion of his judgment, and also my agent was the one who organized the suit. But as a consumer, I really like Google Books. That as a consumer of intellectual property, I want a world where every book ever published, I can go up on the on my computer, and in 3 minutes, there's the text of the book on my screen. And maybe one could argue that that means we ought to have either no copyright or copyright with a much shorter term. And the argument here would be that if you have copyright with a 10-year term, say, now the benefit of being able to make everything instantly available is larger than the cost of having a little bit less produced because of a lower incentive. Whereas in the old days, where there wasn't an important reason why I wanted copyrights to vanish in 20 years. I mean, the only way I got a book was to go to a library, and I could go to the library without violating copyright, whereas Google can't web the book without at least serious problems with violating copyright. So that's at least one way of thinking about the question, that the cost of copyright arguably has risen for two different reasons. One of them is that preventing copying is hard. And the other is that permitting and copying is more valuable than it used to be because of the fact that you make the stuff up. But I have an interesting example of this, although it was one consistent, I think, with copyright. I hope it was. And that was, with regard to my other seminar, there was a book, a long out-of-print book, which the author told me what had the information that I wanted, basically. This is on the question of how traditional Somali legal systems worked. And there's a English scholar who's sort of the world expert on the subject, and he's in his 80s or 90s or something, and I had read several of his books and gotten some information, and I said, look, is this summary correct? And he said, well, look at book X of mine, and that's where you'll find the information. Book X, I couldn't find anybody selling book X. But I found an online service which would give you a one-day trial, I think it was one-day trial subscription for free, and which had the book. Well, one day was enough to read through the book, copy those chunks I want to quote in various ways, which almost certainly is fair use, and then cancel my subscription at no cost. I looked for another book I wanted. If they'd had more books I wanted, I would have subscribed for a year or something, but for one book I wasn't willing to. But you can see that whole process would be a lot easier in a world where copyright expired quickly. And there's a sense in which I'm acting on that principle, because my books are web. Whenever my publisher lets me web my books, I web them. And that's a case where I suspect many, though not all authors, really am writing books mainly to get out my ideas and only secondarily as a source of income. And the more you're doing that, the more you ought to like the idea of short copyright terms. Anyway, it's an interesting set of issues. So that then gets to my question, which is, I think it comes after yours, because it really hinges on the whole question of cost versus benefit of copyright. There's no cost to copyright, and there's no reason to cancel. So suppose suppose technological protection works really well, which I don't expect is going to happen, then should you abolish copyright? And the counter argument would be, well, locks on doors work pretty well, but we still have trespass laws, so maybe you should have both of them. But if copyright law imposes serious costs, then you might say, all right, if technological protection is a pretty good solution to the problem, if it's enough to make sure people can get paid, then let's abolish it. And of course, it doesn't have to be technological protection. Suppose what we observe over the next 15 or 20 years is that it's very hard to enforce copyright, that lots of pirating is occurring, and that intellectual property is still being produced. At that point, we might say, look, some authors get paid by being paid to give speeches, some musicians get paid for concerts, some film companies get paid by having a sponsor for the film who gets a good reputation out of it. If the non-copyright mechanisms work well enough, then why have copyright? And that, it seems to me, is a, I don't think it's something we can say now, but it's a plausible thing to think about. There's a sense, I think, in which everybody is too conservative. And that's related to this course, because my conclusions writing the book is that people's view of the future is way too conservative. That I've seen an attempt to estimate the costs of global warming, which attempted to run the costs 300 years after. Anyone who writes that, I think, is insane. Because it depends on thinking that you have a reasonably accurate idea of what human beings will be doing 300 years from now. Think about somebody in 1800 who was trying to describe the world of 2100. And he has no hope. The problems he's going to imagine are going to be all the wrong problems. The real problems won't occur to him. Right? Spam was not a big issue in 1800. All right? Global warming wasn't a big issue in 1800. But other things were. All right. So in that sense, it seems to me that we routinely underestimate how uncertain the future is. And that's sort of a mistake we're all prone to, and probably because we don't know the future, we know the present, so let's guess that it's going to be the same. Anyway, I'm not sure where that came from. It came from somewhere. Oh, yeah. So therefore, we have an inclination to say, if the way we maintain intellectual property nowadays is by copyright, that's the only way it can be done. And that's probably not true. I think there are a lot of other examples of that pattern. If you think about things like people worrying what happens if the price of gasoline goes up. Back a long, long time ago when OPEC, there was a boycott for a while, and prices went up and various things happened. And I think people didn't allow for the fact that if prices go up, people will adjust in lots of ways, and over time, people will be more likely to live close to where they work and more likely to carpool and they'll buy smaller cars. That we sort of, our first approximation is whatever we're doing, we're going to keep doing. This is related, by the way, to the reason I think sustainability is a silly idea. Because if you take the word literally, sustainability means the ability to keep doing things the way we're doing forever. But the one thing we can be almost certain of is that we're not going to keep doing anything the same way we're doing it. How we're going to do it, we don't know. Anyway, that's a digression, but maybe a relevant one. Let's go on. We're back to KW, I think, at this point.
So this is just, it's sort of like a different way to look at digital watermarks, just because digital watermarks, obviously, they don't work very well. So this is another way that companies I know in recent times are doing things. So now if you purchase a really legitimate source like iTunes, they don't actually tell you this like in their privacy policy or anything, but when you purchase a copy, they actually embed, I think it's just your name and your email address at this point.
In the copy.
Into the copy, but I mean, they don't tell you they do that, but they don't know them to do that. It's very simple, it's just the metadata, so if you have like a community of a small sense of like tech map, you can go in and raise it. So the thing is, as an average user, you don't know that. And as of today, they don't do anything with that, but it's sort of like, is there a privacy concern? Because at this point, it's just, you know, your name, your email address.
But why is it a privacy concern? They're only given to you. You know your name and email.
Well, no, it's not like, is it a privacy concern at all? Is it not? Because, you know, what if, you know, in the future, let's say you do, like, I buy a copy of the thing, then I put it on the server somewhere, and then they can see, hey, look at it, you know, if so-and-so bought it with this name and
address and email address. But, of course, when you put it up on the server somewhere, you're violating their copyright, aren't you?
Right.
But it sounds to me like a sort of low-level version, and so it could be a low-level version of the watermarking to prevent piracy.
Right.
And what I want to know is, has iTunes sued anybody because they found their copy with their name on it being publicly distributed.
They haven't yet, but that's sort of like the conservative coming around it, because again, people don't know. Again, the average user, it's like, you know, I'm paying for this, it's my legitimate copy, but then of course, you know, if we misuse things without realizing that we're misusing them, and right now, iTunes has not done anything, but there's like a concern that in the future, iTunes are kind of coming after them.
I don't think law students get to use we in that sentence. Non-law students get to use we in that sentence.
That's the concern. Is it a privacy concern? Is it an effective way to deal with privacy? And then, you know, if it's just your name and your email address, you're like, well, maybe that's not that big of a deal. And like, well, they have access to that.
Suppose it's all sorts of other stuff.
Well, but it's like, yeah, because you log into your account, right? I mean, you're in the future, they start pulling out your credit card information, your home address. Now is a big concern.
Let me go back for a moment, because this is reminding me of what seems like an unrelated issue, but I think is not.
Okay.
And that is, think about World of Warcraft for a moment. And the fact that one thing you could do with World of Warcraft is to share your account with a couple of friends, as long as, you know, one of you is a day person, one of you is a night person or something, and thus reduce the income they get. Because a World of Warcraft account, I think you're allowed, like, up to 10 characters on each of 5 servers. So you could easily have 4 or 5 people all using it, except for the time constraint. One of the things that limits that, however, is that if somebody else has your account, they could log on to your character, steal everything he owns, sell it on the sort of semi-black market, and leave. So that there's a sense in which one way of protecting some of this stuff is by having a world where it's dangerous to share. And it's not like Blizzard is making it dangerous to share, right? I mean, it's just, they just point out to you, they just warn you that you shouldn't give anybody else your password. And it's a true warning, but it's also in their interest, because it means that you aren't going to have, you know, 2 high school kids using the same account, or at least you're a little less likely, unless they really trust each other. And if they trust each other that much, they may be making a mistake. But...
Professor, I kind of think that this one should have been read in conjunction with mine.
All right.
We didn't really...
Of the one that yours we just did, or
the next one? Because they're almost the same.
Yeah.
Mine's about transactional watermarks.
Yes.
Privacy.
Yes, yours is certainly related in there somewhere.
Almost the same. So,
right.
Yeah, I mean, there's 2 types of watermarks. Mm-hmm. There's transactional watermarks and just, I can't remember, regular watermarks. So, regular ones, like the ones that are in the book where they record the owner's information, and transactional has owner's information, purchaser's information. And theoretically, the purchaser, but like you said, probably doesn't know it's on there, but they are permitted to remove that. I have no idea how to remove my information from music I purchased, but they
are... ask our expert over here.
it's fairly simple right now, because I mean, it's just, it's not going to make any sense, but you just like put it into like a text file, and it's like erase and attack. Like, it doesn't have to change your file at all. It's very, very simple. But then, I mean, the whole next level is like, what if they start to like... like some sort of like encryption or something,
yeah, right.
You actually can't take your information out. Because right now it's open, it's very easy to take it out.
Yeah, and so, I mean, definitely with the anti-circumvention ones, don't, you're permitted to remove your own information, and that's because of the privacy concern that the law had. And I ran through very interesting.
Okay, so under the current law, you are allowed to remove it if you can.
If you can.
Are they required to tell you how to or not?
I don't know.
And do you know, are they required, I'm assuming they're not required to disclose to you saying, hey, you know what, when you buy this, we're stamping your name on it. As far as I know, and again, I don't know like the recent privacy terms and conditions, but as far as I know, like right now, nobody says anything. So when you're buying that, unless you happen to know, it doesn't say.
Do you actually read, when you sign, when you originally signed on to iTunes or whatever, did you read all of the 173,000 pages of...
I didn't read that much, so as far as like when
I skim them.
And you guys are, so it's funny too, actually, for my data jokes, like I don't have to read a lot of them, but I actually read the probably more details than people do.
And you're pretty sure that they did not mention it.
I mean, I would say 100% sure, but I mean, at the time, it doesn't say, you know, when you buy it, we're going to slap your name on it. So I don't know if there's, I mean, I'm assuming there's a lot saying they need to disclose that.
Yeah.
Even if it's hidden in that.
Yep. But at the level where all they're putting on is your name, it's sort of a little hard to see what you're complaining about. Because
what you're saying
is, I'd like to be able to pirate your software without people knowing that I'm the one doing it. Right, sure.
But I sort of feel like it's sort of like a test drive. It's like, like what happens here, we're just capturing their name and email, and then, you know, it just starts to track that, like, up at a level somehow.
But why do they want more? That is, what is their perverse motive that makes you suspect that this is just an entering wedge?
Oh, just because piracy is a very difficult thing to be in technological protection work. It's so easy to overcome, but it's just trying to attack it in a different way.
So, is that objectionable? Then suppose they do or don't tell you, but suppose that every time you download something from iTunes, they conceal in it in a way which you can't figure out how to remove your identifying information. And why do they do that? So that if you put it up on the web for people to download, they can come after you for a violation of copyright. Why is that objectionable, or is it objectionable?
Well, that's the question, is it? I don't know. I mean,
it seems to me, I don't see how if they tell you they're doing how it could be, and I'm not sure if they aren't, if the only reason that you would object to it is that you were planning to do something illegal.
Right.
I don't know. Are there any real space equivalents? Are there any cases where you have a right to a form of privacy which is only being used for criminal purposes? I don't know. Yep?
One of the cashiers in the store, because that's not his fingers, kind of like that. And his lawyer says, you know, stop stealing from the owner. He's like, how do you know? I was like, well, that's the only thing to do. This is because of dust, you know,
his hands are information or something like that. So that, I don't think is. I mean, the whole idea is to try to catch them on red handed almost, right? But the simple law is against that at all.
I just feel like it's like, if you suspected somebody was a drug dealer and then you tracked them after they got a cannabis card and like started following them, when your only reasonable suspicion is watching their legal activities, and like if you're going to...
Is you the police or a private actor? Because I'm not sure the rules are the same.
The rules aren't the same, but I think it's a fundamental, like, it's, I'm not talking law right now, I'm talking like fundamental sense of fairness.
Uh-huh.
But I think that's why it kind of bothers them. Like, even though they may not have anything they're technically doing wrong, they're kind of like they're tagging and bagging you for the future, and it's like without you knowing. I feel like we live in a culture where most people are accepting of the idea that there's a lot of people that pirate things, and there's sort of, you know, it seems unfair when somebody, a private citizen, gets, you know, they get, you know, multi-$1,000 fine for having like 4 movies. Like, do you really think it's fair to go to jail for pirating Ice Age 2? Probably not. But, you know, there's like the few people that do it, and then there's the masses that kind of get away with it.
Under what circumstances is this copyright infringing criminal rather than civil?
Sorry.
I'm not sure there aren't any. It's a real question. I'm not a lawyer. Because
yeah, no, I just remember I was being melodramatic when I was in college, and I had a roommate who kept pirating off of my internet, and I was getting the letters.
Yes.
And so, and he pirated Ice Age 2, and so I was like, if I go to jail because you're an idiot, like, I will come back with this shit and get you.
Uh-huh.
That was, like, my line. I don't think you can go to jail, but I did get hit with a letter warning me of $10,000 fines, so it's like, yeah.
But of course, one of the issues here, which is sort of a much broader thing, is to what extent does it make sense to say we're going to keep the law, but we're going to make it hard to enforce because we're not sure we like the law, as opposed to saying, well, if you don't like the law, maybe you should abolish it or change it.
Well, I think the issue is that it's not really enforced now, and they're going to change...
Copyright is enforced, it's just not enforced very effectively.
Yeah, but if they're going to make it more effective all of a sudden, they're going to change the way it's enforced, I think... maybe feel a sense that they should be entitled to know if they're selling themselves down shit creek.
So you would say that if the California Highway Patrol starts stopping speeders when they're going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, even though it's been common for them to go 20, that there is something wrong with it, that that's objectionable, and they should at least put a special warning about it. We've now started enforcing our laws.
I know they put out commercials that say we're cracking down on seatbelt law. They could have pulled you over before, but they at least gave you a courtesy note.
Don't you think that the reason for that commercial is they want to get people to wear their seatbelts, not that they feel they owe you a fair warning?
Well, maybe we should be encouraged to buy things instead of pirate.
Well, it might well make sense for the if you have, as a trade-off in a sense, in the watermarking context, is that on the one hand you want to deter people from piracy, on the other hand telling them too much might let them evade your protections, and so there's sort of a trade-off between those two objectives.
Another interesting argument that I read about with transactional watermarks is that they're violation of free speech, because if the owner of the work decides to use it in conjunction with some other expression, say make some sort of political statement, then one of the things that that person probably values is anonymity. And if somehow their identity is attached to that,
I'm not sure I follow this. This is a case where you download Das Kapital or some other loaded work,
yes,
and you now want to somehow use it in anonymously making arguments against the bailout or something or other.
Yeah.
And you're afraid that since you're planning to have on your webpage the Das Kapital you downloaded,
yeah,
that you're afraid people will identify you through that.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was a stretchy kind of argument, but I thought it was one that was quite interesting,
yeah,
because frequently people use music or other things to express their
how far, that is, my impression is that there are cases arguing for a right of anonymity, but I'm not quite sure how far it goes, in a sense. Because it's not quite the same thing as free speech, although it does seem related to it, because it makes it easier,
yeah,
to...
It just seemed that it would lead to kind of a suppression in speech if people felt that they kind of could feel better.
But again, you've got the problem that if the work is copyrighted, which is the reason they want to watermark it,
yeah,
then you shouldn't be putting it up on your web page anyway.
Yeah, I was searching, I couldn't quite understand that, because I was like, how are they using this work in a way that isn't a copyright violation,
but
they're also
reveal
expressing
it,
their, yep, opinion at the same time. But I guess they were making that if you use the work in conjunction a way that isn't exactly...
You could imagine, you'd have to work at it, you could imagine,
yeah,
a case, suppose the identifying information is embedded in a non-visible fashion, and suppose you make a fair use of the work.
Yeah.
And fair use is a very fuzzy concept, as you probably know, but suppose it is a fair use, then you could be revealing it. So I guess that's not, it's not an absurd idea, I don't think. So let's see. I've lost track. Ah, we now have LJ again. So how come this table is responsible for all the questions tonight? Two of you have been putting your heads together and brewing up puzzles for us. Anyway, go on, read it. There must be a conspiracy.
So this question, I feel like it started to get addressed earlier in a few lines of discussion, but the issue of having just access be what you bargain for, as opposed to having a physical copy that you keep on your machine. So getting towards things like World of Warcraft, where you have a login. And I think the main issue, like you said, was making it dangerous to share, so somebody could deplete your resources that you're paying for. But I think there's also times where, you know, like she was talking about the unlimited access concept, where you're going to pay a flat rate, and then you have just blanket access to the website. And I think there would be an interest for copyright holders to not give that, because if you have like a movie service, if two people have a password, that's double,
right,
the movies.
Or in other words, if the password sharing becomes common, mm-hmm, that's an argument for selling it by time rather than by unlimited, right? That unlimited is very convenient, and that lots of things like World of Warcraft, there's no limit on how many hours you do it. On the other hand, phone calls there is, and you could see that if you're worried about, in a sense, let me take a much more mundane case. You go to a restaurant, which is an all-you-can-eat restaurant. They don't want you to take a doggy bag with you. And they don't want you to say, well, I'm getting the all-you-can-eat salad bar, and my wife is getting the salad, because she's not very hungry and doesn't cost very much to just get the salad, and then I'm going to share with my wife all the stuff I get off the all-you-can-eat salad bar. It's really the same issue in a lower tech version, that if you're going to sell unlimited access to something, you have to limit it, in effect, by who gets to use it. Yeah, no, that would seem to be a...
I think the main problem would be if you... if you get people, and I think, you know, increasingly the generation gap of, like, computer savviness is getting where you have to be better and better at your craft to succeed at keeping up with, like, hackers and encryption processes. And, like, you know, I remember reading something from XKCD that, like, a string of common words is a much stronger password than what a lot of people employ, which is, like, a word with a few vowels changed into letters, or, you know, the name of their dog. The things that people think are safe are not necessarily what's actually protecting them. And as people become more sophisticated in how they move about on the internet, it seems more feasible to me that people who are left behind a little bit are more likely to get their accounts compromised. And my kind of wondering is, like, how would you deal with somebody who's trying to prove, like, look, I was, you know, my account was stolen because I don't know better, I don't know what to do, versus somebody who, you know, as becomes more widespread, a lot of people will probably just try to get away with sharing it.
But it seems to me that if it's an unlimited use, it's really easy, because as soon as you know your account is compromised, you tell the people you're buying it from, and they cancel the account. So the real problem, which is a problem which exists, I think, now with phones, is if it's not unlimited use. If you imagine the case where you carelessly lose your cell phone, you don't notice it for a few days. And during those few days, the people who have found your cell phone have spent 40 hours talking to India or to China. I don't know, maybe India is cheap by now, but at least it used to be the case that foreign phone calls were really expensive. And so the company says, you know, I found your phone, here's your $7,000 phone bill or whatever it is. So that's not a problem with unlimited usage. And you could imagine a case, though I don't think anybody's likely to do it, where they actually track the hours of usage. I mean, if you are on World of Warcraft for 20 hours a day, every day, they may suspect it's not you, because people have to sleep some. It seems to me that the problem you're raising is really a more serious problem in the limited use context, because there you are getting billed for something, and how do you prove it was stolen? And, you know, the sort of the hard line answer is, well, it was your fault it was stolen, you pay the bill. And the alternative answer is, yeah, but then nobody's going to buy our service, so we've got to swallow it and just say, we'll believe you, don't do it again, change your password, and so forth. And you could imagine either of those as possible outs. All right, let's see. I think I got this right. We have another LJ, don't we?
Yes. My last one.
Don't worry, guys. Well, I'm happy about the fact that we're now getting new people putting things in. I mean, it's sort of boring for me if I'm just recycling ones from previous years.
Yeah. So the last issue is kind of on the less financial liability side of things, and more on the what I'm sharing with other people, which you can't easily take back once you share it.
Yep.
What I'm kind of thinking of with this question is the person who, you know, accidentally clicks the like button on an adult website and ends up with their Facebook showing that they like you porn.
Right.
You know, and they maybe don't have the tech savvy to realize that they're opening themselves up to this kind of disclosure. And I think...
Does Facebook show what you like?
Oh, it shows more than you realize.
So tell me about it. I don't use Facebook.
It's increasing...
I have a page.
...exponentially as time goes on. So... You know, at one point you could look at it a certain way and see what the rest of the world sees, and now they have this ticker that goes on the side, and you don't actually see your own activity on the ticker, but it'll explode without you even realizing it with, like, everything you do. And they've limited your privacy settings now. I used to be able to make it so certain people couldn't comment on my Facebook, and that was fantastic because I have some annoying friends. But now I can't stop them unless I just take them off my list. So it's they're making it so... It's almost like a site where you go in to just be like, here's everything, and if I don't like it, I just need to disassociate myself with it and not have any...
That is presumably one explanation of what's going on, mm-hmm. is that people care less and less about privacy. This is what, as I think I've commented, struck me about my elder son and his ex-wife's flaws, that they are willing to tell the world intimate details about their life, which I'm not sure I would tell even to my best friend. And And as I think I mentioned, I had a paper in this seminar one of the previous years by somebody who was commenting. The paper was really about the degree to which her generation had lower expectations of privacy than in the past. So maybe the answer is that 90% of their customers like this, other 10% better go somewhere other than Facebook.
I mean, I think that's true to an extent. I also think there's an issue of people not understanding what they're signing on for or not analyzing what they're doing.
Yes.
And I just, you know, I feel for the person who ends up destroying their own reputation because of the things that they do on Facebook. And absolutely, law students are given these, you know, hour-long lunch seminars on how to clean up your Facebook because, you know, if you have pictures of yourself with red cups, you're kind of, you should pretty much put that on the wayside and not...
Pictured yourself with what?
Red Solo cups, you know, the alcohol cups.
I don't know, but anyway.
Okay. But it's like keeping a clean image is, you know, a value for certain people, especially...
There's something I haven't checked yet, but I've heard ads on the radio for something called, I think, reputation.com,
yeah.
Which, as far as I can tell, is a firm in the business of keep maintaining your reputation online. Whether it really does it, I don't know, but that's the claim.
Yeah, I mean, I think those kind of things will crop up and become more popular as time goes on, but I feel like a lot of these sites originated as sort of private, let's be in a little club, and now that they're changing, which I think is the point, is that it's not that they're what they are now, it's what they used to be versus what they are now. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people aren't making the changes, and a lot of people aren't keeping up with it.
Uh-huh.
And I just feel like there's going to be this sort of fallout as time goes on where, you know, how tech savvy do you need to be to protect yourself on these sites? Just because you signed up doesn't mean the whole...
But the other question that this raises, in a sense, going back to sort of keeping a clean image, mm-hmm. is at the point when you can get quite a lot of information about everybody, are people going to become more accepting of the fact, yes, of course people sometimes drink alcohol. I mean, what do you think how come when I go into the grocery store, two aisles are alcohol? There's got to be somebody drinking it. And that in a sense, in a world where it's easy to conceal private information, the fact that you let people know that you drink might be taken as evidence that you're sort of careless or drink a lot or something. In a world where everybody can see everybody, that's less true. See, I thought about some of this issue about 15 years ago when I set up my website. And the question, because it's really, in a sense, the same issue long before Facebook. But the question was, I've got a bunch of different activities. Do I want to put them all on one web page? And the particular things I was concerned with is I've had this long-time hobby of historical recreation, which involves things like organizing the translation of medieval cookbooks and cooking recipes from them and things. Do I want a potential employer to say, what kind of a professor is he? He's obviously a waste. He's obviously a dilettante who wastes his time on these irrelevant activities, so why should we hire him? Similarly, I'm a very extreme libertarian. I'm an anarchist. That's a minority opinion. Did I want people who wanted to associate with other contexts to know those things? And I decided that it was more trouble than it was worth to try to separate my lives. So my webpage has my four worlds. One of which is my political stuff, one of which is my medieval stuff, one of which is my academic stuff, one of which is my family. And sort of my view at the time was a university that really doesn't want to hire professors because they have odd political views, or doesn't want to hire professors because some of their interest is outside their field, probably isn't the university you want to be at anyway. And that sort of is a different way of looking at the same issues. And I noticed that Santa Clara University Law School has got in their cabinet showing faculty publications my medieval and Renaissance cookbook and my novel, neither of which has anything much to do with being a law professor. So that's the evidence that I'm in the right place from that standpoint. But it was an issue that I thought about then because there's a sense in which we've got much better information technology than we used to. And that means that it used to be the case that you could do a bunch of odd things, but hardly anybody would ever find out. And now it's much easier to find out. You know, a sensible employer is going to use Google to learn all about you. That's the world we're now living in. One of the subjects we'll be talking about next time, which I actually just ran into in the last few days, is the sort of dark side about that, which is how I can give you a bad reputation. By, for example, posting things over your name that aren't yours. That presumably, I don't know, how hard would it be for me to set up a Facebook page in your name with maybe a different middle name or in some way so that it didn't actually intersect with yours?
I know in the past it's been harder for people to take that kind of thing down, but now that cyberbullying has kind of come into play as like a viable thing that comes up, there's definitely, like, you can actually report it and they'll investigate.
You'd have to know about it.
Yeah.
How about the case where somebody does it, they really don't like it, so they put a lot of objectionable things on it, and 2 months later you finally discover it and they take it down. People have already seen those things. I don't know, you could probably get it Facebook. People, you know about the Wayback Machine? The Wayback Machine is an internet archive which basically photographs the whole internet a couple of times a year, with the result that if you want to know what was on a web page 4 years ago, you can find out. Do a search for the Wayback Machine. It's got some other official name, but it goes by that too. I was just using it because my first book was published about 1970, and I'd like to do a third edition, and copyright issues arise because my publisher of the second edition holds the copyright. I'm supposed to get the copyright back if the book goes out of print. I think they let the book go out of print. They think they didn't. And the problem is, how do we define being in print? There was a period of years when if you went to their webpage, they said that they could sell you the book in 4 to 6 weeks or more. And one might think that means it's out of print, but they would say not. So I was curious as to, over the years, what the pattern was of the availability of my book on my publisher's website. And I used the Wayback Machine, and I could get about 2 different dates of each year for the last bunch of years and find out over what period it was, how far out of print. Quite a neat tool. But now, suppose that they use the Wayback Machine to look at the fake Facebook page of you that was used to defame you, and the page is gone, but the art is still in the archive. Or for that matter, suppose someone who doesn't like you has basically photographed that page while it was still up there, and then the next time that he's having a fight with you, he puts the photograph on his web page and tells people, look at what terrible things she used to say, kind of thing. I'm thinking partly of a case I've just encountered, which is essentially very much like that one. I was thinking of discussing it probably tomorrow because it's more relevant. But it was a case where in the course of an internal political conflict within a private organization, apparently one of the candidates for the executive board forged a whole bunch of obscene and juvenile posts by another candidate, won the election. The other candidate then discovered it and sued. And that was 7 years ago, and the feud is still going. Because I stumbled into it because people who I think are allies to the person who did the original forgery are still saying insulting and often untrue things about the guy who was the victim of the original forgery. Now, I should say, the guy who was the victim is a bit of a nut, as far as I can tell, which makes it easier to defame him. But not, I think, a nut in the particular ways that might be. All of this, for anyone who's interested, is in the chess world. I'll talk a bit more about that next time, because it's sort of quite an interesting case of stumbling into what I think of as information warfare. How, if you think about the general question to think about for next few times is, if you want to fight somebody online, if there is some person or organization you would like to injure, what are the tools now available? And there was, I don't know if it's still going on, but when I first got into this, which was like 14 or 15 years ago, this set of issues, a lot of it was the Church of Scientology. Because I don't know how much you know about the Scientologists, but they are not very scrupulous people as an organization, and they've got a lot of resources, and they've got ex-members who are critics of the organization, and so they were feuding with the ex-members online in various not-so-nice ways. And that got me curious about the ways in which this technology can be used, and I've got in the book two recent cases, not recent anymore, but they were recent when I wrote the book, where somebody is using the technology in a more or less clever way to hurt somebody else. All right, let's go on. Let me see. Our next person is SR again, right? Or did we do yours? We did yours already.
Or yeah. The other, we skipped yours.
Yeah.
Are you okay with that?
Mine comes next, but no, we did this one of yours.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Then I was raising one, which I find interesting, it's going to come up later for the law enforcement question as well. But suppose my software permits me to monitor your use of it in a way which would be a tortious invasion of privacy if done by a human being. Is it still tortious if the information never goes to a human but simply feeds into a program which tells me whether you are violating your license but not what you are doing? So I'm imagining something like this. I've got some kind of useful intellectual property like a song or a book or something. And just to make it easier for my readers, what you download is not just the song but also the software you play the song on. And this is really nice software, so you'd like to download it if you can do more things with the song than you can. Otherwise, it's free, so why would you object? But this software that plays my song or my movie has some extra features in it, which I may not tell you about. And one of these features is that it's running all the time, whether or not you know it's running, in the background. And it is watching to see whether you are emailing copies of my song off to anybody else. Or maybe the song actually belongs to some firm that's got intellectual property and other things. Maybe the song actually belongs to Microsoft, and they don't care if you pirate the song, but pirating word is a really serious issue. So their free software is keeping an eye on what you're doing to find out whether you are copying word and sending to anybody else. All right? You could imagine that. It doesn't sound technologically impossible. And if you are, it will borrow your machine briefly to send an email to Microsoft saying David Friedman has sent 17 copies of Word to 17 different people. Maybe you should be worried about this. Is that a tortious invasion of my privacy?
I feel like you make a pretty good principal agent argument for that. I heard this in the drone technology, like in war crimes. They say, you know, how would you punish the drone? You can't, the machine, you can punish the person who's giving it directions. So
it's clear. No, I think that part is easy. The question is whether you punish anybody. The question is, given that they have, in a sense, a right to know that you violated their copyright, if there was a human being who had hacked into your computer and was watching everything you did, with the intention only of reporting if you violated their copyright, I think that would almost certainly be illegal, both as a violation of privacy and almost certainly a violation of computer crime law. And the question is, as between a human being observing things and a robot observing things, but only funneling to human beings a very limited sort of information, is there a legal difference? And this is going to be irrelevant. This is really a foreshadowing of an issue that I see with regard to wiretaps. All right. So suppose that we use the technology to wiretap every phone in the U.S., which I don't think is beyond the limits of current technology. But all we're doing is having computers listen to the information, turn the speech to text, chat for keywords. And if certain keywords appear, the computer will send a message to the FBI saying, you probably really ought to be listening to this guy's phone. At which point the FBI then goes and gets a warrant and taps your phone. All right, that's the further future implication, but I wanted to think of it in the private context first, of whether if I get software on your machine which reports to me stuff that in some sense I'm entitled to know, whether that's illegal. Any opinions, any thoughts?
Yeah. I don't even know if this is familiar or not, but I remember reading about a case where I suppose that the thermal heating thing we could detect heat, and it was cops using it. They were standing outside a home, it just used, so they aren't actually going into the home, and they don't really know anything's going on, but then they saw like a huge amount of heat source coming out.
And they concluded it's marijuana growing,
and
that's right.
They just sort of knew it was, and that was like considered a violation of privacy because it wasn't like that kind of what they were right, it's not a reasonable.
But presumably the Fourth Amendment presumably has no effect on private actors, does it? So it has to be a different legal theory. Not that private actors can't do things that are illegal and violating privacy, but I don't think it's because it's an illegal search.
I mean, it's not exactly, you're sort of
trying to
scan,
look like,
oh, look, there's something wrong,
so
let's go look at it.
Sort of
the same.
I don't
know.
Yeah. You're the people who are supposed to know the law. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. You're all going to be lawyers. Well,
will we?
You will be. Probably. Most of you will be. Except for a few who decide to use the information in some other way.
So I don't understand how the principal agent argument is the principal of the person.
The principal is responsible.
The agent is theoretically the software.
I don't have a problem with that. My question is whether what is being done is illegal. If you think about why you don't want somebody watching your computer, you might say, well, on my computer, I'm watching porn. On my computer, I'm sending love letters to my mistress. On my computer, I'm doing lots of things that I wouldn't want other human beings to know about, either because it would embarrass me or because they could blackmail me or things like that. And the question is, can you avoid all of that if what's observing is not a person, if what's observing is something which will, in a sense, to which all of those activities are invisible? All it's doing is looking to see whether you're doing things with copyrighted software on your machine, which you're not allowed to do. That's what, I mean, this, in a sense, I'm really interested in almost more as conceptual than as a legal issue. If you think about the difference between watched by a machine and being watched by a person, what are those differences? And if the machine reports everything it can see to a person, there's no difference. But if the machine is a filter as such and only report very, very few things. For example, my guess is that there is no law against a policeman having his car parked outside of your house and seeing when you go in and out of the door. Even though it may well be that for the policeman to have a video camera glued to your window watching everything inside would be illegal without a warrant. Yes, I don't know. So somehow, does the machine spy avoid the problems with spying by spying on only a very narrow set of things? That sort of seemed to me a conceptually interesting question, which is why I raised it. But we can go on and you can keep on thinking about it later. So we now are back with you again, I think.
This part might be entertaining because I understand infringement is a civil penalty, not criminal penalty, but this perhaps is entertaining. Maybe combined force of law enforcement and copyright owner. So I think if we drastically increase the penalty for infringement, well, once again, you can see I'm kind of hung up on this idea of the infinite exclusive rights of the copyright owner. If we decrease the life of the exclusive rights to the copyright owners, would this provide an adequate level of deterrence? And then this is just a bit of a President Sarkozy once proposed requiring internet service providers to terminate internet access to repeat infringers. I don't know how he proposed doing that, but I propose saying like doing internet warrants where, the computer sends or every time we logged on to a computer, we had to put in a fingerprint. You tried to get on one, the computer said.
To do that sort of thing, you're going to have something like a registry of digital signatures and all of the relevant countries having rules saying you can't go on unless you sign and therefore prove who you are.
Yeah, so assuming something like that is in place, if we, like I said, increase the penalty to say a criminal penalty, perhaps not jail time, but a little internet ban for a certain number of years, would be enough to prevent people from
don't know. But one problem is it sounds like you need a world government to do it, more or less. Right?
Yeah.
That's sort of one of the many issues that comes in all of this stuff is that the way the world, the way the internet is, countries in a sense don't matter as much as they used to.
Yeah. But I mean, in a sense, it seems like a lot of intellectual property law works in the sense that it's trying to be on the same footing with the countries that participate in regulation. So, kind of seems popular now, but it just doesn't seem like the penalty quite matches up these days to deter activity.
So you were complaining the penalties are too high because you could end up in jail for stealing a movie, and you're complaining the penalties are too low.
Yeah. Well, that is exactly, and I don't think I personally, this is just my subjective, I don't hear enough stories of people actually ending up in jail or paying $10,000 fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, if you did know somebody, would that cause you to think twice before making an illegal download?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I just wanted to mention that there was a UN report last year that said that basic internet access was a human right.
Well, but that's all right. I mean, yeah. Being out of jail is a human right too, but nonetheless, we put people in jail after we convict them of things. So she she can cut off the internet access once you've been convicted of some criminal offense, right?
Part of the reason for that was it was based on the upbringing of the country and stuff like that. So the whole point of internet as a basic human right was to ensure freedom and liberty in general, to break the law. And so I think it would be a real problem to ensuring equitable way. Also, I think it was a couple years ago, the RIAA tried to sue LimeWire for more money than the world. It gives you an idea of how.
Who tried to sue who?
LimeWire for $75 trillion, which is, I guess, more money. It gives you an idea of how bad. How hard it is to decide damages
Yes.
Yeah. And the equitable.
That is presumably part of what's going on in the copyright thing is that you've got this statutory damages per infringement, and the technology allows very large numbers of infringements. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see. Where were we?
Somewhere here.
Oh, yes. There actually about it. Don't have much time. We've got a couple of interesting ones. Let me go on to them. We've got. There you are. Right, that's right. California law.
Yeah. So there's a California law that's going to be effective.
So what if they don't have effective copy protection?
They don't have effective copy protection.
What if there isn't? This is, people can read it, but it's basically that you've got to have for all post-secondary, the text have to be available in electronic form. And you're allowed to copy protect it. It doesn't mean you can copy protect it, right? I'm allowed to do lots of things I can't do.
Can't be not legal to be able to.
That's right. So suppose it turns out that there isn't a good way of copy protecting books.
Yeah.
Now you print one book and you're finished.
Yeah, exactly. Well, maybe not, because the thing is with at least the comic formats, you can continuously, you know. You're not limited to the information that you print on the book. You're providing a service of a stream.
So you're assuming that the book is not going to be downloaded, but only going to be streamed?
Oh, no. The information will be downloaded, but it's not just that you are... the curriculum's changed. Professors have made a description of what they want to teach. So what the service actually will be is that, you know, these textbooks, they can provide you information for a whole, you know, 4 years of college or one class for a seminar in college or whatever. And it's up to the instructor to make full...
What I wondered about was whether the solution to this is that the university is only allowed to teach a class which has an assigned textbook if it requires that all students in that class demonstrate they have bought the textbook. This would be a different way of getting around the sort of whole piracy issue. We say, look, we can't stop you from pirating, but the university will be considered to be a contributory infringer or something like that. You could imagine appropriate legal rules to do that. If it allows people to take a course where this textbook is assigned who haven't bought the textbook. Would that work?
Well, you have to establish case on that theory, but I think I would stretch because the university, I mean, to get the university to be a contributor.
Suppose it turns out there aren't good forms of copy protection. And the state of California is compelling the publishers to do this.
Yeah.
And so the publishers say, well, look, that's all right. We only want one small change in the law. And the one small change in the law is that it will provide that any university which allows students who haven't bought our textbook to take a course where that's the text is a contributory infringer.
Yeah,
so you want to respond. I thought that was sort of a fun idea.
I was going to say, is it possible to just have it be through the university and that's included in tuition or whatever?
That would be
it. You have them, they have their entire library available for students on whatever electronic.
So the one way you could do it, that's another possibility, is you could say that the publisher says to the university, we aren't contracting with students at all. If you will pay us $1 million a year, all of your students will have unlimited access. How do we make sure that another university students also don't have access? I think you again have got to say that if a university that hasn't signed up for that deal assigns that book, they're contributory infringers.
Yeah,
or something. That doesn't mean free or infringement there. The law has to, right? Because
I don't understand your problem. If there's a different university that's not a subscriber,
then they assign the book as text. Yeah. Their students pirate copies of the book from friends who are the one that does do it. Right? That's what I was imagining, at least.
Well, I was thinking more of shifting away from the idea of having students that and more of like a welcome service.
Yeah. Ideally, and I had the idea a long time ago, that what you want to do with law school casebooks is not have a single casebook in our sense, but have a CD which had a whole bunch of cases and essays, and then tools to let the professor write a path through that world, which was his version of the casebook. That would be, we're running out of time anyway, and I think we've got at least one more interesting question that we're going to have to skip, but apologies to whoever's question to you again, actually, because it's another interesting question. So, for the last one, we're out of time, but think about how the copyleft concept could be used for things other than software. Because that's an intriguing idea. And you could certainly imagine somebody who says, here is my book, feel free to pirate any of it you want, provided that your pirated version agrees that anybody can copy it.
Or at least I get the notoriety of the author. So I'm thinking, you know, like,
I was thinking partly in the context of fanfic, because fanfiction is when somebody writes his own story set in some fictional world, in Star Trek world, say, and you can certainly imagine handling it by that kind of mechanism.